From KCUR News, this is KC Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Susan Wilson is away this week. Coming up on today's show, two different messages to immigrants in Kansas.
That's why the USDA policy is the way it is. You don't want children living in your community who are hungry.
Rural hospitals lure the type of doctors who are actually interested in going to other countries. And hear another in our series of stories from the restaurant industry.
25 tables filled with people, each of whom wants their eggs cooked a different way, who wants their chicken fried a different way, who wants their chicken fried on top of their eggs a different way.
Plus local memories of Soul Train.
And we love to hear Don Cornelius say, peace, love, and soul!
Listen up for KC Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. KC Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. The controversy over illegal immigration is pitting Republican against Republican in Topeka and turning the unemployment debate on its head. A coalition of business and farm advocates have proposed legislation to allow some who are in the country without legal documents to work in the state's meat and dairy industry. Out in western Kansas, where these businesses are concentrated, unemployment has hovered at half the state average for years. Basically, they have more jobs than workers to fill them. They say they need immigrant labor to stay profitable. Meanwhile, Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach, who's behind much of the tough immigration legislation around the country, is outraged. Laura Ziegler has more.
Chris Kobach made the impact of illegal immigration on voter fraud the linchpin of his 2010 campaign for Secretary of State. In spite of data that minimized the problem, he easily won as part of a statewide Republican sweep. So it was no surprise when the Secretary of State, even though he's the state's chief election official, ripped into the economic development bill introduced into the Kansas House last week. House Bill 2603 would help some undocumented workers become authorized to work in Kansas. Chris Kobach calls the bill a fantasy.
For two reasons. One is it's legally impossible to do that. The people who are pushing this bill apparently didn't realize that there is no way that the federal government can grant a waiver for Kansas to allow unauthorized alien workers to stay here. Secondly, it's politically unfeasible. There's no way that the Kansas legislature is going to pass a state-level amnesty.
Both chambers of the Kansas legislature are dominated by conservative Republicans who've spoken out against the plan. But supporters say the bill is neither a waiver nor an amnesty. Eric Stafford, director of government affairs for the Kansas Chamber of Commerce, which is part of the coalition that wrote the bill, says the legislation would follow the federal immigration process that provides work visas to immigrants.
The difference between the current federal process and what we're proposing is the state of Kansas, which is simply support those individuals through the application process.
Other agricultural states, like Kansas, faced with the reality of agricultural economies sustained by undocumented workers, are grappling with similar laws. The ultra-conservative state of Utah passed a guest worker law, which remains controversial. New Mexico, California, Georgia, and Florida are studying their own guest worker-type laws. The Kansas proposal is being called unprecedented, however. Businesses would subsidize each worker with over $5,000 each. The money would go to support social services and education for immigrants. Stafford says the federal government has pushed states to step in and figure out what to do about immigration, since there's still no effective national immigration policy.
They are not supporting these individuals. They are letting them stay here. Part of the problem with the federal system today is a lack of authorization permits to support the number of workers needed across the country.
Kansas Secretary of Agriculture Dale Rodman has had initial conversations with officials from the Department of Homeland Security about how to execute the plan. But after coming under fire from legislators, Secretary Kobach, and even Governor Brownback, who said he does not support it, a statement from Secretary Rodman's office said no requests for waivers have been made and the talks were informal. Laura Ziegler, KCUR News.
While some in the agriculture industry are fighting to legalize the status of undocumented workers, the Kansas Department of Social and Rehabilitation Services recently cut off hundreds, possibly thousands, of immigrant families from receiving food stamps. Now, non-citizens, even if they're here legally, are barred from what's now called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. But if their children are U.S. citizens, they are eligible for food aid. But SRS just changed its eligibility formula for these mixed-status families. Dave Ranney of the Kansas Health Institute has been reporting on this issue. I asked him over the phone to explain how this policy change came to affect so many Kansas families.
Well, there used to be two ways to figure eligibility. If the two parents were U.S. citizens and they had three kids, their eligibility was based on their household's income and five people. But if these parents weren't U.S. citizens and their three children were U.S. citizens, the household income would be prorated. It'd be divided by five and then multiplied by three. And they do this because everybody knows going in that non-citizen parents are not eligible for SNAP. And by prorating, what you would do, you would make it so the children would be eligible and the parents were not. Just the children would be eligible. Well, what they've gone to now is there were circumstances when, you know, depending on where you were on the eligibility scale, there were circumstances where prorating benefited some of these families by a few dollars. And you kind of had to go out of your way to find instances where this would happen. But SRS is saying it does happen. Okay, so what we've done now is we said, well, we're going to take these U.S. kids with non-U.S. parents, and we're just going to apply their three-person eligibility to a five-person income. Well, when you do that, people just drop off the system. They're no longer eligible.
It looks like they're making too much money for just three people
to qualify. And that's why SRS stood up in front of the House Appropriations Committee last week and said, well, no, this is about income. You know, they're not being dropped from the program because of their immigrant status. They're being dropped from the program because of their income. Well, yeah. But that's driven by the fact that you're, you know, taking three people and basing their eligibility on a five-person income, household income.
Because those families presumably are buying food and necessities for five people, not three people the way SRS is now assuming.
Correct.
How did some of the groups that work with families, immigrant families and you know, other poor families, start finding out about this?
Well, all of a sudden, they just had people show up with letters from their area regional SRS offices notifying them that their children had either been dropped from the program or were being dropped from the program. And, you know, they were told, I mean, in these letters, they were told that, you know, if this is wrong, come in. And of course, this is driven by the parents not being U.S. citizens. So the letters said, well, if this is wrong or you want to appeal, you know, come in and show us that you're U.S. citizens. Well, that raises a whole issue of where the SNAP program is fully funded by, you know, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It's federally funded. So the federal regulations prevent you from asking, if a parent comes in and wants to apply for SNAP for their children, you are prohibited from asking them, well, are you a U.S. citizen? They're not applying. They're applying for their children. And the issue is whether their children are U.S. citizens. So anyway, we have SRS saying, well, you know, if you want to contest this, then, you know, come in and show us you're a U.S. citizen, because that's what will change all this. Well, you have, you know, some of the social service programs are, you know, appealing to USDA to, you know, come in and investigate this. That is, as far as I know, that is still up in the air. The whole principle here is that you have children living in your community who are U.S. citizens who are hungry. And this is a program geared toward feeding the hungry. That's what SNAP is about. So if you've got these children, they're U.S. citizens, and they're eligible, you know, they would be eligible, you know, if their parents were citizens. The idea is to, you know, concoct this formula in a way that will get them eligible. That's why the USDA policy is the way it is. You don't want children living in your community who are hungry.
And how many families that were previously getting these benefits were cut off by this rule?
Well, the new rule took effect in October. And in October, between October and November, you had 311 children drop from the program. In November, you had 2,066. And then in December, and these are the latest numbers, in December you had another 439. Well, so now you have about 3,000 fewer people are on the program today than you had 4 months ago.
Do we know if that's because of this particular change in policy, or could these be people who got jobs and are now making more money?
Well, SRS makes the point that people come on, go on and off SNAP all the time, and they think that probably about half of these folks were mixed status families. But when you ask how many children were in these mixed status families that were dropped, well, they don't know. And then during the committee hearing last week, you know, SRS was asked, well, what's happened to these children? I mean, are we tracking them? Do we know if they're hungry? Do we know what's happened to them? And SRS makes the point, well, you know, after they're out of the system, we don't, you know, we don't track them. So, no, they don't know what's happened to these kids.
And this committee hearing that you're referring to was called by legislators who are concerned about the change?
Yes. The committee chairman agreed to have the hearing at the behest of several Democrats on the committee. But the committee, at the same time, many people on the committee raised issues like about people using their food stamps to buy beer and cigarettes and lottery tickets, and people who've stood in line at the grocery store buying hamburger and watching the person in front of them with a Vision card, you know, which is the debit card that has your SNAP benefits on it. They watch the person with their Vision card buying T-bone steak. I mean, these stories refuse to die, and they're present in the legislature. And so, you know, they had the hearing, they raised the issue, they talked about it. The committee chairman, you know, essentially said, you know, I think we'll let SRS deal with this. This looks like, you know, SRS is selling this policy as one of equity, that now all families are treated alike. We don't have this dual system anymore. Everybody's being treated alike.
How has Governor Brownback responded to this issue?
A reporter approached Governor Brownback after a photo opportunity here in Topeka and asked if he would reconsider this whole issue, and the governor said that he would. Well, and so this is the age of the Internet, so he goes back and writes a story, and, you know, in 30 minutes it's up on the Internet that the governor is going to reconsider this policy. Well, by the end of the day, he's notified by the governor's office that, no, there's been a misunderstanding. What the governor wants was a better understanding of the policy, and that, no, it's not going to be reconsidered.
How do other states handle their supplemental nutrition assistance program benefits?
That question was asked during the committee meeting, and SRS replied that there are three other states doing, that Kansas is doing what three other states do it. And those three other states were Nebraska, Utah, and Arizona. And a legislator made the point, well, then you're saying that 47 other states, or maybe 46 other states, essentially do it the way we used to do it, that they would prorate citizen kids living with non-citizen parents. And essentially the answer was yes.
And some of the social service agencies that are looking for change are now looking to the Department of Agriculture to possibly step in.
They're hoping that the feds will at least review what's going on. Now, SRS makes the point that the federal regs do give the states the ability to structure their eligibility determination procedures. And so there is leeway for states to do this. Now, most states have chosen not to do it because they don't want thousands of children to be dropped from the program. They're geared toward having these children, hungry children, fed who are living amongst us. Sister Therese Bangert, who is a longtime advocate for the poor there in Kansas City, who does lobby in Topeka, she is talking to legislators about, you know, let's go back to the dual system that we used to have. You know, if equity is the issue, then pass a law that says, you know what, U.S. children living in non-U.S. citizen parent households can't receive more in food stamp benefits than a U.S. citizen. And do it that way instead of the way we're doing it now, which is dropped. They call it mixed-status households. It's not like the mixed-status households are getting less. A lot of them are just being dropped altogether. That's what the problem is.
Dave Ranney is a senior writer and editor for the Kansas Health Institute. The money saved from cutting families from the food stamp rules will be returned to the federal government. Coming up, the latest in our Servers Tell All series from an event at the Writer's Place. You're listening to Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Susan Wilson is out this week. Recruiting doctors to live and work in rural America is a chronic problem. Most places try to roll out the red carpet, offering big salaries, expensive homes, or other perks. But in southwest Kansas, a tiny hospital is building a reverse recruitment model. It's called mission-focused medicine, and it's based on serving problems most commonly found in third world countries. From Harvest Public Media, Peggy Lowe reports.
It's not easy getting to Ashland, Kansas, population 855. After the five-hour drive south from Kansas City, you land in one of the last outposts on the Kansas Open Range, where buffalo still really roam along these windy, dusty plains. There's no gas station here, unless you count the pump at the farmer's co-op that uses dial-up for credit card approval. The nearest Starbucks, 160 miles away. The Ashland Health Clinic has 24 beds, but if there's no doctor there, the next closest is 50 miles north, in Dodge City. So when Benjamin Anderson interviewed for the clinic's CEO job in 2009, he says the board chairman was exceedingly blunt.
Ben, our facilities are 55 years old. Our finances are challenged. Our morale is low. Turnover's up. We've been out without an administrator for 6 months. We've been out without a doctor for 7 or 8 months. We really need this facility in this community. And if we don't have this facility, we'll lose our school. And if we don't have our hospital and our school, this will become a ghost town very quickly.
That pitch clicked for Anderson. He gave up his physician recruiter job in Dallas and moved with his wife out here to become Ashland's new CEO.
I've always had to have a job that matters. I have to have a position where I know it's not just a paycheck.
Hello, Benjamin.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Anderson is now well known on Ashland's Main Street, but he couldn't succeed here alone. He needed doctors, and he knew he had to offer something different than the thousands of small towns he was competing with. So he came up with a novel plan. He offers potential candidates 8 weeks off to do missionary work overseas, because he's found that a doctor who is willing to sleep on a cot in the Amazon or treat earthquake victims in Haiti is ready to serve in rural Kansas. Anderson calls it mission-focused medicine.
When you recruit a mission-focused provider, they want to see the ghettos. They want to know that there's no Spanish-speaking provider in more than a one-hour drive. They want to see houses that are falling down, widows that are uncared for. They want to know that there's need and that by them coming there, they would fill a disparity that would otherwise not be filled. And so we reversed it.
It worked. Last July, Dr. Dan Schumann and his family moved here from the Austin, Texas area. The difference between here and all the other needy areas was his ability to continue his missionary work in Haiti and Mexico during his 8 weeks off. But Dr. Schumann says Ashland's own challenges were equally attractive.
When your primary focus is sort of a mission-based focus, when you get into things in order to try to relieve suffering or work towards eliminating disparities, then you want to know about those things, and it's appealing to see opportunities.
Studies suggest that finding primary care providers in rural areas is at crisis levels, according to the National Rural Health Association, a Kansas City-based group. More medical students are specializing, so general practitioners are very hard to find. And those who can deal with the lower pay and isolation in rural areas, even harder. The association's Brock Slaba says taking the focus off a paycheck and instead placing it on a passion is a good recruitment tool.
Because often in rural communities, the vision isn't very large in terms of what they're there for. And so if you can expand the vision from an organizational perspective to have a much broader base in terms of the meaning that's provided to the work that you do, that's incredibly powerful.
Staff meeting in the dining room at 2 o'clock, and all staff meeting in the dining room at 2 o'clock.
That's what Anderson has done in Ashland, raised the bar by shooting for a higher cause. At every staff meeting, he's part cheerleader, part chaplain.
All right. So together, let's read the mission statement. Entrusted with people's lives, we are committed to provide, enhance, and preserve the health care of our community with compassion, dignity, and excellence. All right, that was all right first round. Let's try that again.
Things are looking up for Ashland. In addition to Dr. Schumann, Anderson has recruited a nursing director. And that doc who slept on the cot in the Amazon, she was recently in Ashland for interviews. She, too, is attracted to a perk that can't really be paid for. Meaningful work. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. A couple of weeks ago, waiter and writer David Hayden hosted I'll Be Your Server Tonight, where servers, bartenders, and other restaurant industry folks share their deep, dark food service secrets. On our last show, we shared Mark Manning's story about growing up in the restaurant industry. It's up on our website in case you missed it. As David Hayden tells us, it's not at all like Cheers.
I never once saw Sam Malone mop a bathroom floor. I never once saw Sam Malone do a roll-up. I never once saw Sam Malone get yelled at by a guest who didn't get theirs in the end.
Well, the next story we're bringing you isn't from Sam Malone, but it is from Kansas City bartender Jeff Esparza. Here he is talking about when he just started serving at a diner, kind of like Denny's, in Northern California.
I was able, working about 20 hours a day, constantly, without a day off forever, to earn enough money to really do whatever I needed to do. It was really pretty amazing. Without a college education at that point, or graduate school education, which, by the way, is all it's gotten me is a job slinging drinks at a fish restaurant. I wish it were a joke. It's not funny. but at the time, I was waiting tables at a very busy but very run-down diner called Caro's in Concord, California, which is vaguely comparable to Independence, Missouri, east of about 20 miles east of Oakland, 30 miles east of San Francisco. And at Caro's restaurant one morning, just like any other restaurant, nobody calls in sick. Well, two servers had called in sick, and there were about 50 tables in the restaurant, which is a pretty good-sized diner. The only person working was a young woman named Wendy. And when I say young woman, she couldn't have been a day younger than 80. She was the strongest server you would ever see in your life. When I walked into that restaurant at 7 in the morning, she'd been going since 4:30. And she had been going with every single table in the restaurant full. She had everybody's drinks in front of them. Food was ordered for everybody. She was running around like a mad person. Moving faster than I had ever moved in my life. Moving faster than I had ever moved boxing. Moving faster than I had ever done playing basketball in my friends' backyards. I mean, this woman was moving. So I walk into this restaurant. As a fairly green server, I had been a fry cook, a dish boy, a bus boy, and, I was 19 years old, barely 19 years old. I barely knew what I was doing serving tables. I walked into this restaurant and started, back waiting for her. For those of you who don't know in the industry, I basically did anything she told me to. I was her boy. I sat there, I pulled beverages off the tables and refilled them. I pulled plates off the table. I took orders for guests that she needed to, and I started my own section, started taking tables. This isn't really part of the story. The important part of the story, really the end of it, for anybody in the restaurant that would know it, is that by 9 o'clock, she and I had taken every table in the restaurant, and it was entirely full. This can be extremely stressful. There are a ton of things going on when you're running 25 tables at a restaurant. 25 tables filled with people, each of whom wants their eggs cooked a different way, who wants their chicken fried a different way, who wants their chicken fried on top of their eggs a different way. Every drink concentrate needs to be defrosted to prepare the big batches of things that are going out. There's a ton of stuff behind the scenes that you're doing at a diner that isn't like waiting tables at a restaurant that's mediocre or highbrow, like the one that I work at now, where everything's sort of done for you and all you have to do is tell bad jokes and say really offensive things to get people to like you. You had to do a lot of things as you were going to prepare for this. And so by this time, I was quite frazzled. I was running, literally running, sprinting through the restaurant to do things. I was helping the fry cook, the single cook, cooking all of this food. I was helping to make the food. I was helping the drinks being made. And through the door at 9 a.m., I saw two women in their 70s come through with pink aprons, bright blue shirts, and ties tied like ascots, with their hairs still in curlers, pulling the curls out. They draped down like angels. These women marched in with their shoulders up, and their chests booming out. And they said, "I'm here. I can take tables." These women in their 70s all walked in. Everybody was in their 70s that worked and dined at this very blue-collar diner. Very blue-collar diner in a blue-collar Hispanic town in the East Bay. And everybody's first language was Spanish that dined there, almost everybody. They walked in, and when those curlers fell out, I don't think I've ever been happier in my entire life. It was like watching an elderly Mexican Superman blast through the doors. And it's not like I ever sat down and said, "I want to be that person." Because I don't know. I don't want to work in the industry anymore. I've been awarded too many degrees and worked too long to still ask, "Do you want fries with that?" Which I ask all the time. "Do you want fries with that?" That happens. It hurts my soul every single day. Not to demean any of you in the industry, but it's you all know what I'm talking about. But someday I hope to make somebody feel as good as I felt when Trisha, Yolanda, and Juanita walked through the door at Caro's in Concord, California. That's all I've got.
Local bartender Jeff Esparza told his story at I'll Be Your Server Tonight, a recent event at the Writer's Place hosted by David Hayden. This week, Don Cornelius, creator of the dance show Soul Train, died at the age of 75. Soul Train first aired in 1970 and was one of the longest-running syndicated shows in television history. Our own Susan Wilson was a big fan. She has her own memories of Soul Train, and talked to some other Kansas Cityans about theirs.
With his deep baritone voice and lush afro, Don Cornelius featured black artists who otherwise would not be seen on network TV shows at that time. For the white community, Soul Train provided a window into black culture. In fact, some say that Soul Train and the music it promoted bridged the divide between black and white communities at that time. When Soul Train came on, African-American youth across the country were glued to the TV. In Pittsburgh, I remember watching the very first show, with Gladys Knight and the Pips belting out my favorite jam, I Heard It Through the Grapevine. I remember feeling flushed with excitement and pride. Every week I would tune in to check out my favorite R&B artists and catch up on the hottest dances and trendiest fashion, like wide leg bell bottoms, huge hoop earrings, platform shoes, and let's not forget fringed leather vests, mini skirts, and multicolored jumpsuits. And by the way, I was happy to sport my very own Don Cornelius-sized afro. Yes, Soul Train was our American bandstand, the can't-miss show of its time for us. Not even a Saturday sorority girl road trip to Penn State University could stop us from watching. We timed our travels so that we could arrive at the Delta Sigma Theta suite, just in time to crowd around the television set to watch Soul Train.
We'll be coming back at you later in the show. Right now, we turn our attention to the Soul Train gang, the Soul Train line, the master storyteller, Mr. Curtis Mayfield, and the showed-up boss, Pete Shaw.
So I asked fellow Kansas Cityans, what were some of their favorite Soul Train memories?
No matter what we were doing, where we were, we all met back at the house to watch Soul Train. We'd get up, try to do the little dances, which we couldn't do, but we had so much fun mimicking the dancers, trying to sing the songs, and we loved to hear Don Cornelius say, peace, love, and soul!
I've been watching Soul Train since I was like about 7 or 8 years old, if not younger than that. You know, my favorite thing was the Soul Train line, and still today, you know, when I go to family gatherings or parties, we still do the Soul Train line.
Listen to everything he had to say, his voice, how his voice was, how he talked so smooth, so cool with it, and just brought everything to life, you know. And just that era has never come back, and this era now, I have no idea. Best thing about it, no fighting. It's just a beautiful thing.
I remember Al Green's first appearance on there. I remember Michael Jackson's first appearance on there. And I think my sisters and them used to watch it to watch just to see what outfit Cornelius would come out wearing. You know, they thought he dressed nice. You know,
I thought they taught me how to dress on Soul Train. The hip is closed, and everybody from Al Green. I love Al Green and Aretha Franklin and Chaka Khan. And I just thought that when Don Cornelius did his dance, I watched it, and it was amazing, and I'm doing every dance with him, so I wanted to be on there. I would practice at home, and that's what got me started thinking I was a little superstar at in Kansas City home, and that's it.
I grew up in a small town, and we watched Soul Train. It was very inspiring just to see people that look like me. You know, we had American Bandstand, but I couldn't relate to that. It was just nice to see black people in entertainment and doing things, and it was such a positive experience, and I really enjoyed it.
And even now when I go places, seeing people do the Soul Train line, like when I do my Zumba class, we do a Soul Train line.
It was like having a free concert on TV. And seeing Don Cornelius say love, peace, and soul. And seeing that afro shake, you know.
Bet your last money it's all going to be a stone gas, honey. I'm Don Cornelius. And as always in parting, we wish you love him.
Susan Wilson talked to Florence, Lady Kay, Kim, Allie, William, Roy Thomas, Cherie Burton, and Gladys Zahler-Jones. After the break, an audio artist happens to find some amazing tapes in the attic of his new house. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Susan Wilson is out. In area news this week, a judge let the new Missouri congressional district map stand. A coal-fired Kansas power plant was put on hold again, and legislators talked about dissolving the Kansas City School District. Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
The latest bill aimed at determining what will happen to the unaccredited Kansas City School District would dissolve it and divide the kids up among neighboring ones, and create tax credits for a scholarship program for private and parochial schools. Catholic educators like Jude Hunts supported the idea.
Why should a person who makes that choice have to pay twice for their child's education?
Diocesan officials said they could accommodate 1,000 Kansas City District transferees, and the bill was promoted as one to rescue neighboring districts from an enrollment flood. But Byron Clemens of the Missouri chapter of the American Federation of Teachers commented,
"Any foundation running from the Show Me Institute to the Scientologist group could have access to public dollars in this."
In St. Louis, Archbishop Robert Carlson said many Missouri Catholic schools are likely to be closed or consolidated in coming years because of declining enrollments. Kansas officials said it's unlikely they'll reverse a new food stamp policy that will end the assistance for more than 1,000 kids. Michelle Schroeder of SRS said the old policy favored households that included illegal immigrants.
"Inherently unfair that U.S. citizens were held at a higher standard than households with ineligible non-citizens."
A Kansas City Star article said the new policy doesn't count undocumented parents as members of households, but does count the income they earn as family earnings. A federal judge put a controversial coal-fired power plant in southwest Kansas on hold pending a federal environmental impact statement. The Sierra Club's Scott Allegrucci said that statement will have to address greenhouse gas emissions.
"That was the rush that was put on, and it created, we and others believe, a lot of concerns about the process and the permit as granted, because it appears to have been rushed in order to beat federal greenhouse gas guidelines."
The Sunflower Power Company declined to speculate on what those analyses would mean for the plant's future. A Kansas Senate committee approved a congressional redistricting map that puts Manhattan in the 3rd district and ends the split of Lawrence between the 2nd and 3rd. Committee Chair Tim Owens of Overland Park called the boundaries fair.
"I think it's very cleanly cut. I think it's as non-political as we can make it."
The State Chamber of Commerce and the Kansas Republican Party called the committee map a capitulation to Democrats. Plaintiff's attorney Gary Griman testified in court that Congressman Emanuel Cleaver's district is an example of how new Missouri maps failed to meet standards of compactness.
"It takes part of Jackson County and then globs onto a 3 largely rural counties, Ray, Lafayette, and Saline. In fact, Ray sits on top of Lafayette like a chimney."
On Friday, the court ruled that the maps can stand as drawn. University of Missouri curators meeting in Kansas City postponed a decision on tuition increases, but interim president Steve Owens said the governor's proposed 12.5% funding cut for next year will inevitably result in job cuts.
"If it stays in place, it's inevitable that there will be job losses, there will be positions that go unfilled, there will be program reductions, and there may be some use of reserves."
The curators will vote on tuition increases ranging from 3% to 8% later this month. This is KCUR.
A pipe organ is custom designed and created for a place. When the Cassavetes Frere organ at the spiral-shaped Community of Christ Temple in Independence was first played nearly 2 decades ago, one critic called it one of the most glorious organs in North America. It was this sound and design that led the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts to also choose Cassavetes for their pipe organ, scheduled to debut in March. For a series called Artists in Their Own Words, KCUR's Laura Spencer talked to the Community of Christ organist about the complexities and joys of the instrument.
My name is Jan Craybill, and I'm the principal organist at Community of Christ headquarters in Independence, Missouri. People are very curious about this building when they first walk in because they see this spiral spire that is part of the outside of the architecture of the building. And as you enter what is going to become the sanctuary, you ascend and you walk around half of a revolution of that spire. And so you go from what is intentionally a darker space, and as you ascend, you get lighter and lighter and lighter. And then when you get in this beautiful sanctuary, you see that the spiral continues up to the ceiling. And so it's like being in the middle of a conch shell. People look up and they usually either gasp or they become speechless just for a moment because it's such a beautiful space. I remember Garrick Olson once played with the symphony, and he talked about every note affecting how he played the next note. And on the piano, you can do that. On the organ, it's more about the complexity of multiple keyboards, and you're playing with your hands and your feet. So I can play the same pitch on the same keyboard, and I can be a trumpet player or a string player or a flute player, all of these different sounds that can be played separately or together. For this piece, my feet are going to be playing a flute sound, and my right and left hand are going to be playing kind of echoing sounds back and forth. This piece is Bach's re-envisioning of Antonio Vivaldi's Concerto for Two Violins and Orchestra. And so in this particular section, my right hand and left hand play the violin parts, and my feet play this constant D that the orchestra plays. And then later on it gets more complex, and I do actually use the computerized system. But for right now, it's just Bach the way Bach would have been heard. It's difficult to describe the sound of any organ for me because there are 102 different sounds that you can combine in various ways. So this organ can roar and it can bowl you over with just the sheer strength of the sound, and then it can whisper too. And so every program I play here, I try to show that the organ doesn't have one sound.
Jan Craybill is the principal organist at the Community of Christ Church in Independence. Her story is part of KCUR's Artists in Their Own Words series, edited by Laura Spencer. DJs pride themselves on the rare grooves they can dig up and play for audiences. But there's another kind of audio lover who searches for artifacts of eras gone by, whether it's radio broadcasts, commercials, or speeches. In a new series we're calling Crate Diggers, we're bringing you some of those stories of the search for lost sound. For this one, Casey Kern's Alex Smith talked to an audio artist who found some unusual recordings in his own house.
When Tim Goodwillie was growing up, he played around with tape recorders and loved collecting old recordings. As he got older and his skills improved, his tape experiments started to approach the music concrète of composers like John Cage and Halim El-Dabb, who used pre-recorded tape to make music. But when Tim went on to study sculpture at the Kansas City Art Institute, the destruction of analog tape became a problem.
Even in art school, I was spending more time at home playing with my answering machine than I was, you know, in studio. So I was mostly in the library or playing with my answering machine in art school until I was getting bad grades, and then, you know, I started making some art.
After college, Tim and his wife Heather lived in L.A. where they ran a music venue. They moved back to Kansas City about 3 years ago. In their new Overland Park house, Tim found a treasure in the trash left behind by the previous owners.
In the attic, there was this plastic bag full of reel-to-reels. And my wife and I hooked up the players and started listening to them, and most of them were recordings of the KCMK Dinner Bell Jamboree.
Now then, Mr. Randy, it looks like it's your turn again. And Randy's got his teeth all fixed up, and he's really able to sing a good song now. He's a great guy, Randy Ritter, and he's going to do a tune now called From a Jack to a King, and here is Randy.
From a jack to a king, from loneliness to a wedding ring.
It was, cold and rainy outside, and the kids were either taking a nap or over at my mom's house, and we were playing them, and it was just super dreamy, because it's like the movie Somewhere in Time with Christopher Reeves, where he falls in love with this girl from another time, and he has to put all the right change in his pockets and wear the right clothes so that he can go back in time. It was like the weather outside and the weather on the recordings was somehow like syncing up. It was making this really... And I spent a lot of time just once we digitized them, driving around Kansas City real slow, listening to the recordings and just kind of, Christopher Reeving. Well, at first, I thought it was some sort of, hokey thing where they're, doing this sort of 50s fetish, about this imaginary 50s kind of thing. I could tell it was an old recording, but it seemed a little bit... But then the more I listened to it, the more I could hear that, older radio cadence. Kansas City, Kansas,
State Avenue in Kansas City, Kansas. That's Kendon Mobile Home.
The Dinner Bell Jamboree originally aired on KCMK 93.3 FM in the mid-60s. At noon on weekdays, the hour-long show featured live country music performed by an in-studio band. It was sung by three men, Randy Ritter, Don Johnson, and Gene McCowan. These men also served as the program's announcers.
Again, we had a couple of letters to ask us if we'd do the Hank Williams song called You Win Again. Well, the news is out all over town.
I'm a huge fan of melancholic music, more than any kind of noisy or experimental stuff. So, this music was amazing because, in America, I think the best melancholic music is country music. I think it trumps blues.
For Tim Goodwillie, the commercials in these old broadcasts are nearly as valuable as the music. They reflect an older, laid-back style of local radio. And the Kansas City these ads portray is a simpler, humbler place.
Gene McCown, the Tune Twisters featuring Randy, Chuck, and Pee-wee, can be heard six nights a week starting at 9 p.m. at the Silver Spur. Meet congenial and friendly Frank the bartender. Also see Jack Crew.
And it's stuff that I remember from the 70s and being the back of a car while, your mom's in the grocery store when that was still legal. And the AM radio's playing. And, Mel Hilliard Chevrolet. Come on down to Mel Hilliard Chevrolet. There's a point with Mel Hilliard Chevrolet where they're advertising the new Camaro. It's so new that they don't even know, the speaker doesn't even know it's a Camaro.
The Corvette and the all-new Camaro. Today's special from Mel Hilliard Chevrolet, a 66 Impala.
Where it fails is how it becomes real and where it becomes located and fixed in time space, but then also makes it seem more haunting.
The highlight of the Dinner Bell Jamboree was a singing contest for local amateurs. Daily winners would return to compete for the grand prize, a chance to record in Nashville.
All right, fellas, it's time to call up our talent again, and here is Ruth McClung. McClung. I have a terrible... Let me spell it for you. M-C-C-L-U-N-G. Now, remember, Ruth is our talent contestant today, and so is Bob. We'll have Bob up just a moment, but right now, here's Ruth, and you ain't woman enough. Take my man.
Love me anymore, and I'll have
actual musical ability of a lot of these amateur singers is sometimes questionable, but Tim says that's really not the point.
The thing with country music, too, and folk music, the lo-fi nature or the lack of skill, the amateurism, makes it even more endearing because it's just pure passion. You know, it's not, it's about just like broken hearts. It's not about, you know, anything other than, you know, it's not a show of skill necessarily. Not to the musicians. I mean, there's amazing instrumentals on these recordings. But it is that, like hard earnesty, like no irony, just like, you know, true faith about, you know, a broken heart.
Tim Goodwillie is an audio artist and obscure music DJ. For Casey Currents, this is Alex Smith.
Sometimes a man's caught looking at things that he don't need. He took a second look at me, but he's in love with me. Well, I don't know where that leads you. Oh, but I know where I stand. And
thank you for tuning in to Casey Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the Casey Currents page at kcur.org. You can also sign up for our podcast and get the show delivered fresh to you every week. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at Casey Currents. Casey Currents' assistant producer is Alex Smith. Kayla Regan is our intern. Our theme music is by Approach. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Susan Wilson will be back with me next week.